Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. The Syracuse stage is under new leadership. My guests today are Jill Anderson, the new managing director, and Bob Hupp, the new artistic director. Jill was most recently the general manager of the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center in Waterford, Connecticut, and Bob was the producing artistic director of the Arkansas Repertory Theater. Jill and Bob, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Bob, let me start with you as a most immediate transplant from the South, but you also have experience in New York City as well. What are your early impressions of the overall arts environment in this area?
Very positive. And I know coming into this, I've been here about a month, maybe 6 weeks now. I've got a lot to learn. But I've been very impressed by this area in a variety of ways. And one of the things we've tried to do really early on is get out and see the work of other arts groups in the area. So I've been over to Auburn for the Finger Lakes Music Theater Festival. We've been down to Ithaca to see work at the Hangar Theater. I'm getting ready to head out to Rochester and meet my friends at the Jiva Theater. So really, you know, there is a strong and vibrant arts community here, and I'm really pleased to be a part of it.
And Jill, have you had the same impressions coming
from
Connecticut?
Well, I'm a few weeks behind Bob, so he's got about a three-week lead on me. So far, I've only been down to Ithaca to see the Hangar. But it was definitely one of the things which appealed to me about moving here is that there is such a vibrant arts community, that Symphoria exists, that the Everson exists, that Syracuse Stage has this long history in the community. This is very exciting for somebody coming in from a smaller town.
And I imagine as the managing director, you've reviewed the financial books of the Syracuse stage. Are there any trends in revenue, attendance, productions over the recent years that have caught your attention either as a source of concern or something that provides you with some confidence as you head into this?
Sure. And I should say that what we walked into at Syracuse Stage is set up so well. The staff has done such a great job in preparing for this transition and weathering this transition that things are in really quite good shape. I think like every other theater in the country, we are seeing over the years a decline in subscriptions. So how do you make that up in single ticket income? How do you make an evening at the theater more compelling than perhaps even just what's on stage, which we hope will do the trick alone, but how can we build on that to really bring in other folks?
And I noticed on the webpage, I never really had done the math and thought of this, but it claims that 70,000, I guess 70,000 individual tickets at some point are sold in a season. That's really quite remarkable. I mean, when I thought about that, you know, that's more than half the size of the city of Syracuse. And obviously people are seeing more than one play, some of them, but still. So that's a real number?
It is, and we sure hope to build on that. I mean, that averages out to more than 10,000 individuals seeing any given production in a year, which we're thrilled about, but there's room for us to grow.
Now, Bob, I want to come back to something that you had mentioned right away when I asked you my first question. You said you went into that you're interested in finding out what's going on in the community, and I was reading some of the things that you had said when you were named, and something caught my eye. You said, I'm quoting here, "Artistic leadership means bringing the creative voice of the theater to the community. My philosophy of theater is tied to the idea that we have the rare opportunity to create important communal experiences for our audiences." So tell me more about what that might entail here in central New York with the aspects of our community here.
And of course, I'm still learning the answer to that because the answer varies depending on where you are. It's very sort of, you know, specific to the community that you're in. But it's really about stage becoming that place and continuing to be that place where people feel welcomed, where people feel invited. And it's also about not just bringing people to you, but finding opportunities to get out of our physical space and really work with other community organizations, work with other arts groups, and tell stories and create experiences that are meaningful to people of all ages and backgrounds in Central New York. So, you know, as I say, all of this is, you know, and of course, you could have me on in another year, and I might have an entirely different take on it as I've gotten to know the community.
Well, we'll have you both back, and we'll see how the first year went.
That's exactly right. But, you know, it is about coming to know the community, listening to what engages the community, seeing what our challenges are, what our opportunities are, and finding ways to engage people on their own terms. And oftentimes that does mean getting out of the building we're in and working in the community. And that's the sort of things we're starting to explore even now.
Do you have any experiences from Arkansas and specifically that you think you may import some kind of version of that here or you're considering?
I don't think anything specific that will be a direct comparison, but there were plenty of times I was in Arkansas for 17 years, and we did a lot of engagement around the 1957 desegregation crisis in Central High at Central High School in Little Rock that celebrated its 50th anniversary while I was there. And we created work and telling stories that had never been told that happened surrounding that crisis. And we did a 3-year oral history project around that experience of people who lived it and people who were living in the legacy of that experience. And so that took our work outside of the building. It caused us to engage a lot of community partners. And things happened artistically and in the community that we never expected when we started the project. Those kind of wonderful surprises are what sometimes are the most meaningful outcomes of that kind of community engagement activity.
Would it include, too, and Jill, I don't know if you want to jump in on this one as well, but choices about production in future seasons, thinking about what is this area going through and what plays might have most resonance for that? Because, you've got, a counter argument of theater brings in these experiences that people map onto in their own ways, and it doesn't matter whether it's set in, Los Angeles or wherever.
To some degree, yes. And keep in mind, in the bottom line, at the end of the day, our job as theater artists is to tell great stories, to entertain, to engage. The work at stage will continue to be eclectic, and we will engage the best storytellers to come to our theater and create these stories on our stage. And how they relate to – sometimes it's an immediate, specific reference. Sometimes it's more a more abstracted connection to the work you see on the stage. So it's not like every play, we can say, okay, this is the relevance by, what we're doing. But sometimes it's more abstracted. And together, hopefully, over the course of a season, you come to see those themes and ideas pull together.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Bob Hupp and Jill Anderson, the new leadership team at the Syracuse Stage. Let me follow up on this question about choices in production, and I'll put it to both of you. And Jill, maybe we'll start with you. But Central New York, and I'm pushing on this sort of, what is the nature of Central New York here in terms of the arts? But Central New York is not like New York City, where there are many different theater companies and theaters that can carve out niches, and be known for one thing as opposed to something else. So how do you think about pitching the lineup and the plays themselves when I would imagine that you need to be, if not all things to all people, at least many things to many people, 70,000 tickets. So how do you think about that?
I think it's many things to many people, but also recognizing that simply due to the geography, folks who live in Central New York do have other options. So there may be things that people are going into Manhattan to see. There may be things people are traveling elsewhere in the region to see. So I think we do want to be many things to many people, but also have to find what that spot is in the ecosphere of the Central New York theater community. We've understood that our folks are traveling to other theaters in the region. Finger Lakes is doing such great work with musicals. Bob has said we don't see ourselves becoming a 6-musical-a-season kind of theater company. That's something they're doing well. So I think continuing to attract broad audiences where we can is key.
Well, you're right on the money when you talk about, for the years that I ran a small company in New York City, our survival was dependent on a fierce adherence to our mission. And occupying that niche, in this instance, it was the classics of literature told in rotating repertory with a resident company. That was the thing we hammered in on all the time about this was our identity. And you're right here. You have to be the opposite. We have to find ways of creating family-friendly work where people can bring in, where entire families can make stage a part of their lives, and also appeal to people who are more discerning and who want sometimes a deeper and longer engagement with theater. So I think, and that also entails telling new stories and creating new work. And that's something we expect to focus on as well. My personal passion, my personal background is in the classics. And so, how does a theater company define itself by how it interprets works that have a large and sustained artistic footprint? So here you have the classics, you have new plays, you have those plays that can be gateways and entrance into the theater for families and for people of all ages. How do you create a mix? And one of the ways you create that mix is not by thinking of seasons just in terms of every 6 plays, But you think in terms of a couple of seasons or a couple of years, because you're not going to cram in everything every season accomplishes where you can check off, you know, everything you want to accomplish, because there may be exciting new artists you want to work with and you want to bring those voices to our stage. And so how can we do that? How can we partner with our, you know, our friends in the drama department at Syracuse Stage, which is we share facility and we share common goals and common values. And so how do we do all of that? Well, you can't do all of that in 1 year. So you have to look out over a period of time, and that causes you to sort of expand your horizon a little bit.
It's a thought process the drama department takes into account looking at every student's arc, and it's something I think will be very helpful for us. They look at that four-year arc. We can think in a similar way.
You're listening to The Gamble Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guests are Jill Anderson, the new managing director of the Syracuse Stage, and Bob Hupp, the stage's new artistic director. Well, what we've been talking about leads, in my mind, at least to an even bigger question about the arts and connecting it to considerations of the economy and the culture in Central New York. This place, and I'm pushing this point a bit, but this place is different, I think, from where each of you is coming from. And this area has mightily struggled economically in many ways in recent decades, and the city is deeply challenged economically. And in that kind of environment, I think sometimes arts can become downplayed by government and by community organizations that support it in the face of what appear to be more pressing needs. And so I was wondering if each of you could speak a little bit about how you view the relationship of the arts and the theater, more specifically, to the community under those kinds of conditions, and also how it might fit somehow with revitalization and regeneration. I don't know who wants to start in on that, but I was, Jill, I'm very curious to hear what you think about this question.
I've come here from a community where I've seen this happen with my own eyes in the 10 years I spent in New London and Waterford, Connecticut. That's a community that also has seen its share of struggles. It's seen industry leave. It's perpetually got its military, industrial businesses in jeopardy. And what we've seen there is the arts having a really visible, tangible effect on foot traffic downtown, the economic development of a downtown that had been abandoned by many of the traditional residents. Much of that there is focused on the visual arts and music, but the corollaries between what theater can do, whether a big institutional theater like Stage or some of the smaller work that's springing up around the city, it's absolutely measurable. I think it can absolutely revitalize blocks, neighborhoods, entire cities.
You know, we've seen the arts be a good model for urban revitalization and economic development across our country. You can look at medium-sized, small, large cities that have invested in the arts to serve as those drivers of economic renaissance. You know, the arts, and particularly theater, we're really urban pioneers. You know, we need facility to create work, and so many theaters are willing to go into facilities that others might avoid to create work. And then we've also seen where you have that activity, restaurants and other development follow. Now, you talk about the concerns, the economic concerns here in Syracuse, and I get that. You know, I've come here from Little Rock, Arkansas, which shares similar challenges economically. But here's an example. Jill and I have both chosen to live in downtown Syracuse. We live blocks from the studio here. And we see an energy, and we've talked about this, we see an energy, we see a commitment both in the community leaders that we've met and just the people that I'm meeting in our local restaurants, in the apartment building where I live, people who are committed to making Syracuse a great place to live. And we're seeing things pop up. And this, I think that, you know, just my observation, and I've been here 6 weeks, so what do I know, right? But just seeing and feeling the energy of this downtown area, and the arts can be a huge part of that. And it's not always about just, you know, the big institutional thing, but it's about how we work at the street level and how we work to engage young people, everybody who wants this city to succeed.
Well, I'll say one thing. You got the Syracuse versus Syracuse right in your brief time. It took me 20 years to get that. So Jill, let me return to you with a question about the finances of the theater and its relationship to the university. The university has had some budget concerns and And there have been pressures to cut back, pressures to generate more revenue. I think all the units of the university are feeling that. How does that play out for the Syracuse stage, and have you had to respond or think about responding in particular ways?
Sure. We are so grateful for that partnership with the drama department and the larger body of SU, and we've had fantastic, consistent partnership and support from between the two entities over the years. Of course, there are pressures pushing on both sides. We realize the value of Syracuse stage to SU and vice versa is something that, while I want to say it almost can't be measured, it actually can. And we're working on making sure that both parties in this are getting what they need, what they desire, and that we can continue to strengthen each other. That financial support absolutely is a reason Syracuse stage is as strong as it is, and certainly that works the other way as well, that they can attract students to that department based on the strength of stage's reputation and the artistic opportunities.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and I'm talking with Syracuse stage directors Bob Hupp and Jill Anderson. I want to think about the season coming forward, ask you some questions, and Jill, I know you had something you wanted to make sure people heard before the first play opens.
Well, our public performances don't begin until October, but we'd be thrilled to welcome as many of your listeners and the community as we can to an open house on Saturday, September 17th. It's been a little while since stage has had one. There will be one mid-morning to mid-afternoon performances for families, tours of the facility, a chance to meet and greet, grill us a little bit more in that setting, and I think we're going to have a taste of the Regent neighborhood, a lot of local restaurants participating too.
Nice. Now, Bob, what play this season most intrigues you?
That's a tough question because I find the entire season intriguing. Certainly, I think the two Pulitzer Prize winners, Disgraced and How I Learned to Drive, are two that I find most intriguing. I'm curious to see how audiences react here in Central New York to these two very different plays.
Give us just a quick overview of the plot summary, if that's the right word to use for a play.
Sure. How I Learned to Drive is a memory play about a woman who was recalling a very traumatic experience that happened to her in her youth that gets into issues of abuse and other things. And she's recalling it from the perspective of adulthood and how she processed and how she moved on from those experiences. That's How I Learned to Drive. And Disgraced really gets into issues of the American dream and who we are and issues very current now with issues that happened in the Middle East. And it's a story of a successful young man who
He's Muslim, right?
He's Muslim, that's correct, right. Yeah. And his own identity is called into question by things that happen at a dinner party. And so those are... I think plays that really cause us to examine what's happening in our lives today, who we are, how we think of ourselves. Those are fascinating plays to me, and I'm anxious to see how our audiences respond because that'll help me understand our audience in perhaps a more meaningful way.
I wanted to ask you a question about Disgraced because one of the things I noticed when I was looking at the schedule is that it starts its run just after the presidential inauguration. And as you mentioned, Bob, it centers on a Muslim American and deals with these issues of identity and racial and religious prejudices. How I Learned to Drive, I mean, those issues have been perennially in the news, but have been in the news a lot in the last year. Was that timing, though, of Disgraced? I'll ask Jill, was that coincidental? Because I looked at that and I thought, wow, that's a very interesting time to open that play.
I'm afraid we can't claim any knowledge to exactly how the time slots were selected. We're lucky enough to walk into this very strong season programmed by our predecessors. Bob, you may have some insight into the particular timing that I lack. But
no, I don't. I think that – and that's the great thing about timely – engaging plays is that we will find reasons for them to be where they want to be because they're important plays. And I think that so I can't speak for Tim Bond, who selected the season, in terms of the timing. And it could be something philosophical, like what you're saying, or it could be the timing of the availability of the director. I mean, I didn't have that conversation with Tim about the timing of Disgrace. I know that there was conversation before I came here about whether or not Disgraced would be a part of the season, and I was very glad that it ended up in our season. Because you're right, you look at plays like How I Learned to Drive and Disgraced, and what you see then in the con- context of a season that also has Great Expectations and Mary Poppins and Death Trap and Ain't Misbehaving. And so while you have these plays that do allow us and invite us to confront important ideas, you also have plays that might just be a fun date night out or a fun evening where you can bring the whole family down and have one of those experiences and create memories that will last a lifetime. So that's what I think is so wonderful about Stage's upcoming season.
At least one play that's, I don't know, for lack of a better word, the fun play? Is there always a sense that there
every play is a fun play? That's, of course, a subjective judgment about what somebody thinks of as fun. I think, of course, theater wants to be fun. You always want that experience. You know, we're asking people to come down and spend an evening with us, and we want them to have fun.
Well, let me follow up on this, and I'll get a little personal if I could. But I find, and I enjoy plays, but I also find, for most of them, that at the end of them, I'm exhausted. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because there's something about a live performance which brings me into the tensions and the oftentimes conflict and the drama that the actors are experiencing and portraying. It's different than any other kind of film, television experience. I mean, I don't know if you want to comment on that. Maybe that's a place.
You've written our marketing materials for us that kind of engagement is unique to the live theater.
Come to the play and get exhausted. But I mean,
I'd rephrase it.
It is that kind of experience for me. And
well, it is. Okay, so when you go to the movies, nothing's going to change on the screen. No matter what you do, nothing is going to change. When you go to theater, the art happens when the actors on stage and the audience come together in that space. And everything changes because of that relationship. And I think that's what you're characterizing as maybe being exhausted. I would think maybe you're exhilarated that you've had this.
Not in a bad way.
Oh, I got you. Right. But it's an opportunity and an experience you can't get anywhere else. You can't get that kind of charge. You can't get that kind of buzz anywhere else except in a theater, because you have that communal experience that you've shared with all those other people and with those actors on that stage for that one time. It'll never be the same again. It's going to be different every night.
And we just got a few seconds left, but I have a minutia question that I just have to ask, and you'll have to just excuse me here. But I even noticed it in your materials on your website. Sometimes theater is spelled T-H-E-A-T-E-R, and then you refer to other theaters in the United States with an R-E. What is going on there? Do some theaters have a different sense of, oh, we're more highbrow, or what is the difference in this spelling that I see over and over again?
That may be the biggest minefield of the morning, Grant.
Uh-oh, I only left a couple seconds for it.
I've worked at theaters that are very focused on American plays before. Sometimes they've chosen the spelling E-R for that reason. There are others who cling to the more traditional R-E in respect to the history and heritage of our industry. Bob Hupp.
There are a variety of reasons. Bottom line, it becomes personal choice. The New York Times spells it E-R. We spell it R-E.
That was Jill Anderson and Bob Hupp. The Syracuse Stage opens its season with Great Expectations on October 19th. Jill and Bob, thanks so much for talking with me.
It's been our pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.